Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers. I'm Richard Edelman. I'm together with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News, and we're old buddies. George actually worked for my former colleague, Leslie Dock, on the Dukakis campaign.
A million years ago.
87, 88. And then actually went on to glory in the Clinton White House and stayed in touch with us ever since. Mm-hmm. And you've really done such a fantastic job in the news business. So I really want to start out with your new book, The Situation Room, which I read over the weekend. You cover the room not as a room, but as a place of strategic importance for the country. That, in fact, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy felt, even before, when the Bay of Pigs happened, that he was poorly served and needed better information. And that's why, you know,
he was angry. Yeah, he felt the Joint Chiefs and the CIA misled him. And so he wanted his own separate stream of information and intelligence coming in to the White House, which is why the Situation Room was set up. One of the things I write about is I was surprised that there hadn't been a Situation Room before John F. Kennedy. Of course, we all know Franklin Roosevelt had the map room. Other presidents had rooms where they centered their decision-making during wartime, but there wasn't a permanent space until Kennedy set it up, and they built it very quickly. They built it at a cost of $30,000 in 3 weeks in 1961. The irony is that once it was built, Kennedy didn't use it all that much. He didn't like it. He called it a pig pen. He did use the information. He used those independent streams of information that were coming to him, but he didn't like the room itself.
And so as events transpired, as there started to be, for example, your story about the Nixon 1973 and the role of Kissinger. And so just go through that a little
bit. This is October 1973, the first Yom Kippur War. But what was happening in October was the Nixon presidency was unraveling. Mm-hmm. Spiro Agnew's vice president had been indicted. He was gone. The tapes had been released, the Watergate tapes had been released. The articles of impeachment were being written up. The judge was ordering the turnover of more tapes as well. And Nixon knew the walls were closing in on him. And as this is happening, the war breaks out. The Yom Kippur War breaks out. But Nixon is completely obsessed with what's happening, understandably, what's happening domestically, what's happening to his presidency. He thinks his presidency is going down, and he isolated himself up in the old executive office building, a private hideaway office where he would basically drink a lot of scotch, listen to musicals, and knock himself out every night as this war is going on. So it led to what I write about in this book, one of the most extraordinary meetings in the history of the Situation Room. As this war had unfolded, the U.S. was quite worried, and Henry Kissinger, who was the National Security Advisor, was quite worried that Russia was going to take advantage of this. And in the course of the night, as this was Saturday night, they saw Russian warships heading towards the region, and Kissinger and his team had to decide what to do. What they decided to do was to raise the nuclear alert level to DEFCON 3, which had only been done once before. During the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. But I was alive then.
I was alive, but not I was a baby. But they did it without any knowledge of the president of the United States. He was completely passed out. And they were willing to take this move because they thought it was essential. Thank goodness it worked. But it was one of the most dramatic moments in the Situation Room ever where the president wasn't present. And one of the things we learned many years later is when the Soviet archives were released, is that the Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, while Nixon was drinking scotch up in his hideaway, the Soviet leader was knocking himself out with sleeping pills and vodka in his dacha outside of Moscow.
How ridiculous.
So we had this huge superpower confrontation, a game of superpower chicken, where neither leader was actually in control.
Absurd.
Yeah.
And then also the rather riveting story of Osama bin Laden and the decision to go, no go, and sort of 60-40.
At best, yeah.
And then Gates, no, and then yes, and
well, that was the highest stakes decision, obviously, of the Obama presidency. But as you point out, the intelligence was never that certain. Yeah. They had been collecting it for years. They knew about this person named the Pacer who had the profile of Osama bin Laden, who was locked up in this compound outside in Abbottabad, Pakistan never left the compound. They called him the Pacer because he would simply come outside every once in a while and take a walk around the roof. But even in the final meetings where the president gathered his entire team in the Situation Room, there was no certainty that this would happen. The estimates of its probability being true were between 40% and 80%. Obama finally just says, listen, this is a 50-50 call. We just have to make it. And he was willing to bet his entire presidency on it. As you point out, Robert Gates, who is his defense secretary, was the lone voice in the room who advised against the rescue mission. And he was colored by his experience during the Carter administration when he was a CIA analyst over the failed helicopter rescue of the hostages in the desert, in the deserts of Iran. And he was worried, actually, that he had, sort of lost his nerve because he had been dulled by that experience. But Obama thought it was useful to have someone at least raised the caution flags. Now, what the story I tell in the book, which was related by one of his top deputies, Michelle Flournoy, Robert Gates' top deputies, is that when he went back to the Pentagon, Michelle and her colleague went up to him and said, Mr. Secretary, you simply can't be against this. We can't have it. We've gone through all of the contingencies as well. We believe this is the right decision. And they convinced him to turn it around. And when I was interviewing Michelle, she actually gave me a little bit of credit because many, many, many years before in the Clinton administration, we had been friends going back to our time together at Oxford. She had come to me when she was about to issue a report that was on the Somali operation that was fairly critical of many in the Pentagon brass. And I gave her a pep talk and said, listen, that's what political appointees like you and me have to do. We have to be willing to stand up and take the heat with our bosses if we believe we're giving them good information. She was kind of bucked up when she went into Gates and remembering that story. And it turned out pretty well because he did call the president back, came out for the mission. And of course, 2 days later,
but I also remember in your book, George, you say that they learned because they had two relief helicopters. And when the first helicopter sort of crashed Bin Laden compound, there were two more ready to go.
Which was not the case during the operation to rescue the Iranian hostages, because Admiral McRaven and everybody in the military had gone to school on that failed Iranian rescue mission and were determined not to make the same mistakes.
So we also, in this book, read about the courage of one young person who was in the Mayaguez incident, who was a photographer, of all things, speaking up during a White House sit room with President Ford about whether or not to bomb a Cambodian boat.
David Hume Kennerly, he was a Time magazine photographer, just 27 years old when he met Gerald Ford. Ford became president, asked him to come to the White House as his photographer. He was like another son to Gerald Ford. And he had actually been in Cambodia in the weeks before this meeting. And he felt he had a decent feel for the possibility that this wasn't some centralized, organized operation. It was a lot of rogue entities, almost warlords. He made that point in the middle of the meeting. Now, this was astonishing to me, because, you know, having worked in the White House, I know that the ethos of the White House photographer is you're in the room, you're the fly on the wall, but you never say a word. He was not hesitant to speak up at all, and Ford ended up following his advice. Did not fully appreciate the fact that Kennerly was willing to kind of speak up in the middle of that meeting. Told him, next time you have something to say, say it to me in private. But Kennerly was right. And you're right, it did take some courage to speak up in that moment.
Unbelievable. So I want to talk to you a bit about your day job, not just a writer. The three big changes that we've observed in the 25 years of the Edelman Trust Barometer are the mass class divide, top quartile, bottom quartile, difference of opinion in institutions, much less trust in the bottom quartile, the rise of business as the most trusted institution, certainly relative to government, and then the third is the huge battle for truth. And since you're engaged in that battle for truth every day, what's changed in the last decade that has made it so difficult to get people to believe a version of truth that's different from their own?
I think you have to go back a little bit farther than a decade. You could say, is it the rise of talk radio in the 80s, the rise of cable news in the 90s? They both had an effect on the fracturing of the media, but it's really with the advent of the internet that things really started to change. And you saw the media universe kind of fracture. People go into their own silos, be able to collect information on their own. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's false, and it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing echo chamber where people only seek out information that kind of bolsters what they already believe. But then it was all turbocharged when Donald Trump came on the scene as a political candidate and was so shameless and brazen about not telling the truth. They chronicled the lies. It was an average of something like 20 major lies a day during his presidency about matters large and small. Of course, he's now known, so well known for the biggest lie of all, the fact that he won't accept that he lost the 2020 election. But when he came on the scene and was willing to power through with alternate facts, in the phrase of Kellyanne Conway, and all his acolytes were willing to do the same, and they were able to convince their most stalwart supporters that they were telling the truth, and all of us in the media who were trying to hold them to account were the ones who were the liars, it blew the whole system apart, and it created a dynamic where those of us who are trying to stick to facts and hold politicians accountable have to risk appearing partisan, even when we're simply pointing out whether something's true or false.
Go through that mental process of correcting the record versus letting the person spew.
Well, I mean, we've all learned that you can't simply allow that to happen. I mean, I have rules on the broadcast that I anchor. I won't put an untrue piece of sound in the piece. What we used to do is say, well, the president said this, and then we'd go and say, oh, it's false. Now I just won't allow it in our pieces at all, because I think that even the fact check doesn't necessarily, in the debate in real time, that's all you can do. But it's a real problem. I think it's one of the reasons why you have to be very careful about even giving people who are prone not to tell the truth a live platform without editing, because those lies go out there and they're hard to corral back. I thought David and Lindsay did a very good job of simply being calm and dispassionate and accurate when they pointed out what the president said of, say, about Springfield, Ohio, was just wrong. There's no evidence to back that up. When Lindsay pointed out that there's no state in the union where it's legal to kill a baby after it's born, even though the president and his team have said things like that. That's all you can do. That's not necessarily going to solve the problem, because you've seen what's happened in the days since the debate. The president will make up all kinds of more lies about, you know, Kamala Harris was given the questions. Kamala Harris was getting the questions in her earpiece. The ABC moderators were partisan hacks who were simply, you know, following orders from me. He said that at one rally last week. Right. And that leads then, you know, to some criticism for them or for those of us who try to tell the truth. I think it's kind of the price you have to pay, because I don't think we can succumb to that notion that if you're going to be criticized for telling the truth, you should just shut up.
So, George, as you've observed the change in media audience, you actually can recognize the growth of sort of social media as the primary means of information for young people.
Oh, I see it with my kids, that's for sure. And all know it's happening every single day.
So how is ABC reacting to this?
Well, we try to put our news out on social media as well. I mean, we try to be in that space, but you're doing it in a situation where there are so many alternate sources of information that you're competing with. You know, the networks don't have the kind of monopoly they had when you and I were growing up. And, you know, all we can do is try to flood the zone and try to educate people to be better news consumers, so they're more alert to things that may not be true when they're getting it in their feeds.
But we're also increasingly telling business to have a shorter fuse on correcting misinformation, because it spreads so
quickly. You have
to
do it right away, right?
Right away. And you have to have third parties who make the case for you and become a buttress, because otherwise you're just going to fall into the attack.
When I was in the White House and when I was working at campaigns, I mean, we prided ourselves on rapid response, but you also had to, you know, sort of pick your spots and decide which charges you're simply going to let go. You don't really have that luxury anymore.
It's a lot harder. Yeah. There's also this sort of tidal wave against diversity, equity, and inclusion, against sustainability, you know, the idea that business has become, you know, too woke. And increasingly, we are having to say to clients, what are your values? Be consistent. Hang in there. Ignore the politics, do what's right, cross your stakeholders.
and communicate what you're doing.
100%. Yeah. And explain and say it has a business motivation. You're not trying to be nice. You're trying to
change
make money.
The culture, right.
You're trying to improve your employee base or like this. So, George, if you were sort of talking to a crowd of PR folks, which you are on my podcast, how can we do what we do better? I mean, I'm increasingly convinced we have to go direct to end user of information as audiences disperse. We have to have more facts, more corroboration of what we say.
And you have to be fast. There's no question you have to be fast. But there's an analogy in politics. You know, one of the things that got to the presidential campaigns now, they still spend money on television, mm-hmm. on television ads, but most of the bulk of their investments now are going into doing everything they can for people-to-people contact. You have to reach people where they live in the most direct possible way, and I think businesses have to do the same.
I mean, I actually believe in the ground game. I mean, this goes back to old-style politics, but if, for instance, you want to persuade people to get vaccinated, you've got to go door-to-door, and it has to be the local pediatrician or internist who makes the case,
people
or even
who
the
they
pastor,
do trust.
The pastor,
yes,
or people like
absolutely.
This. Because dispersion of authority is definitely the law of the land.
No question about it.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.